You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers. I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Fran Barber. Welcome, everyone. It's the fifth Sunday of Epiphany, and today we'll be focusing on Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 20, the passage immediately following the Beatitudes, which we talked about last week. In today's passage, Matthew outlines the distinctiveness of Jesus' community of disciples. The community to be known later as Christians are to be salt of the earth and light of the world. So in this week's conversation, we'll focus on the theme of Christian identity as Matthew portrays it, but also Christian identity in our own post-Christendom context. We'll talk about the relationship between belief and behaviour, and specifically what Matthew means by righteousness. We're joined again today by the Reverend Dr. Sally Douglas. Welcome, Sally.
Hi, Fran.
Sally is an honorary research associate within the University of Divinity and an associate lecturer within the University of Divinity at Pilgrim Theological College. Sally's work is interdisciplinary in biblical studies and theology, and Sally's the author of Early Church Understandings of Jesus as the Female Divine, The Scandal of the Scandal of Particularity. And if that's not enough, Sally is also the minister at Richmond Uniting Church in Melbourne. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I'm going to leap right in, Sally, and highlight one of Matthew's hard words, in a manner of speaking, in the final verse in today's passage, verse 20. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. If we're going to read this in church, we need to unpack it, I think. And, you know, if we've got a visitor there or a first timer to church and that's the last thing they remember and it hasn't been explored.
Absolutely.
Not a good thing. So can you begin by unpacking some of that?
Sure. I think with Matthew, throughout this year of Matthew, there's a lot of times when we need to say, okay, this is a Matthean thing, and Matthew's pretty heavy-handed. Some people are really not attracted to this gospel because of these kind of harsh sayings. And I really love Matthew's gospel, so I'd invite us instead to lean in and explore it. So I think for the author of Matthew, there's an incredibly important imperative about your actions actually being lived out. So faith is not just words. It is not just having a doctrinal creed. It's about actually living this out. And we've already heard what it might look like. It looks like mercy. And later on, he'll talk a lot about generosity. So that this is what's important. And I don't think it's an anti-Jewish move at this point. It's talking about a particular mindset. So at various points in Matthew's gospel, Jesus critiques the religious authorities in the same way that we might critique some of our own church structures or the church structures of other traditions when you don't see people living out what the core values are, and the core values are around mercy and peace and gentleness. So I think that would be the first thing I would say about that passage and invite people not into some kind of literalist thing about who's in and who's out, because later in Matthew's gospel, Jesus is really clear about because John the Baptist comes along and he's freaking out because Jesus is not acting in a really judgmental way in Matthew 11. He's not condemning the sinners. He's saying, actually, come and have dinner with me. Jesus has got this reputation for being a feast maker with the wrong people, the people who are not being righteous, because he's embodying this mercy, which he keeps saying is so important in Matthew's gospel, that mercy, not sacrifice, is core. So I think it's a bit polemic what he's saying here, but it's about live it out.
Yeah.
If you want to be part of this community, this is how you do it. You don't just talk about it. You don't rely on your status or prestige. You live it out.
Yeah, I was reading a bit of Bonhoeffer on this passage. Excellent. And we'll probably come back and forth with a bit of Bonhoeffer in this episode.
Yeah.
But he talks in The Cost of Discipleship in particular about righteousness in the gospel being about the union between the king and the kingdom. Mm-hmm. So the embodiment, as you're saying, the walking the talk, put it popularly, of Jesus, and therefore that's what righteousness is.
Yeah.
The union, the correlation, the symmetry between the king and the kingdom.
And we get that language in Matthew. You know, he talks about both doing and teaching the law.
Yeah.
You know, it's acting it out, so it's that ethical imperative here. So it is a very high standard of righteousness. One of my questions of verse 20 is, What would make this behavior superior? I mean,
what would exceed the
fact? Yeah, what exceeds, you know, and for that we look at the wider context, obviously. Mm-hmm. But what does it mean for Matthew to exceed? And I mean that
is that the mercy though? Maybe?
Well, I think we have to know who the scribes and the Pharisees
were.
Well,
I was wondering that.
Yeah. So Matthew uses them as a bit of a foil. They become the kind of other. Mm-hmm. And which is funny because as Christians, when we read the Gospels, we often think the Pharisees as, you know, emblematic of all Judaism, mm-hmm. and yet they're arguably maybe a minority.
Yeah.
It's historically hard to know too much about them because we're just reliant on these kind of sources and Josephus and a couple of others. But they're a sect or a strand within Judaism at the time, right, which was as diverse as Christianity is today.
Absolutely.
So, you know, if someone said to you, describe Christianity, well, depending which part of the world you're in and which denomination, it's going to look very different.
Yeah.
They were the forerunners of the rabbis, we think. So they were very attentive to the law. But you could equally frame that as a really positive thing in that they were deeply committed to the law and to having conversations about how to live out a faithful life to Torah. But in Matthew's gospel, they with the scribes, and the scribes are intellectually elite because they were literate,
right,
do get used as a bit of a foil that often ends up being legalistic.
Exactly. And so in Matthew 23, there's this ongoing critique of the scribes and Pharisees and Jesus is in tears about like the situation. He's just grieving and longing. Don't be like that. And when he talks about that, it's more about being able to justify your behavior and be selfish. So to do particular rituals but to not actually have compassion for those within your family.
That's right. You're missing the deeper.
You're missing the deeper thing, which is that back to that mercy. Yeah, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. So I think that's part of what surpassing.
Yeah, well, surpassing that is with maybe the heart and the mercy and the justice and the, yeah.
So what's really interesting, sorry, I'll just pick up on, so when John the Baptist sends his disciples in Matthew 11 and says, seriously, are you the one who's coming or is there someone else? Because you're just not acting, he's not acting in the ways that John thinks he's going to act. And Jesus makes his kingdom about, you know, John is important, but he's least of the kingdom. Like he's missed the point. And Jesus is embodying the kingdom in such a different way to the way in which John expected, where it's going to be slashing and burning. And Jesus is welcoming and healing and feasting. So I think, and again, Jesus is embodying mercy and that's what surpasses.
I would also wonder here, so in the verses, therefore, verse 19, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. So even if you do that, you will be in the kingdom of heaven.
Yes.
You're actually there.
That's right.
You're just least. So
that's
interesting that it gets more extreme at the end of the passage.
Yep.
When actually that implies someone pretty bad in inverted commas is still in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You just won't have
to
the status.
To me that modifies the hyperbole.
Absolutely.
Can I use that word?
Yeah.
Not the last verse.
I think this is hyperbole.
Yeah.
And I think as preachers we need to be careful. We need to be careful to recognise hyperbole but not necessarily repeat it in uncritical ways.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately in the Christian tradition, these kind of things, these kind of comparisons that Matthew's drawing out gets used to be like, well, Pharisees were hypocrites and legalistic and us Christians know better because we love people.
Yeah, which is anti.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, here again, the Old Testament reading today helps us in Isaiah 58, which, you know, is a prophetic example of this same kind of reinterpretation of the law, because there the image is about fasting and does God require you to fast? This is in a post-exilic community. People are returning to their homeland and the conversation is what does living faithfully to Torah look like in this context? And The prophet there talks about, you know, if God, what God wants you to, the fast that I choose, says God, is to fast from injustice, to fast from oppression, to fast from, you know, not feeding the hungry and that kind of stuff. So it all gets reframed in terms of mercy and justice, which is exactly the kind of thing Jesus does.
Absolutely.
But again, has a precedent. It's already there in the Hebrew
Drawing
Bible
from
tradition.
Those deep wells. Yep. Absolutely.
So the other word is righteousness. Do we want to unpack that? Because that's such a, I mean, people have literally written hundreds if not thousands of pages on this word.
Well, I was mentioning before what Bonhoeffer said about it, the sort of correlation.
Not sure if I agree with Bonhoeffer.
No. Oh, well.
It's pretty
courageous, Robin.
I know. I realise he's a hero of the faith and we should all. No. Well, just I don't find the king and kingdom image particularly helpful.
Well, this is 90 years ago.
Yeah, I know. So in his context, perhaps that made
sense. Especially Germans, where they had kings.
Also, looking at it from a Matthean perspective, so in Matthew 25, Jesus tells that story of the king and who's actually living out the righteousness, and it's people who didn't even know it. It's a story. Mm. People go really wrong when they start deconstructing and saying this is a literal example of what's going to happen. Jesus tells this parable about, you know, the sheep and the goats and so on. The king says, I was hungry and you fed me, and I was naked and you gone. They're like, where? When? What? Yeah. And it's whenever you did it to the least of these, then you did it to me. So again, it is king and kingdom stuff in there. So I can see where Bonhoeffer's, from a Matthean perspective, I think it's got some validity.
Yeah, I can see. And particularly if you think of ancient kings who also had a judicial function. Because this word has a sense of making right or just judgments.
Yep.
There is a judicial or a legal resonance to it.
For me, there's also with this righteousness about, particularly in this passage in Matthew, about integrity. So what's happening within matches what happens without, so in your actions. So there's integrity between, and this is what goes on in the next part of the passage. It's not sufficient just not to murder someone. The call is actually not to slag them off.
Yes.
Like it's a profound call of to integrity, righteousness in the sense that all the way down, we have mercy, not just on a surface level.
Yeah. So there's a rigor Matthew's requiring.
Absolutely.
Yes.
A rigor. An excellence or a rigor.
An authenticity or like a call to authentic mercy all the way down.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, if you remember, and I'm just going to shamelessly plug our very first episode here, where Bill Loder came in and talked to us about themes in Matthew's gospel. Mm. And one of the things he really stressed is this emphasis on ethical behavior, that for Matthew, a lived out faith is always accompanied by ethical behavior. Absolutely. It's not just a set of doctrines or beliefs or a heart orientation. It's got to be manifest in the way you live your life.
But it's not conditional though at one level.
No.
So, when we come into this next part of today's passage, we started at the bottom, but we're moving up. Yeah. You are salt
back,
of the
back
earth.
To the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. Saying that, you know, you are salt of the earth. And again, getting back to Bonhoeffer, he points out that it doesn't say you will be salt if you do X, Y, and Z or A, B, and C.
Yeah.
No, you are salt and light. Mm. In a way, you are whether you like it or not. So your encounter with God and with Jesus. You're gathering with this strange group of people who are listening to this topsy-turvy world.
Yeah.
You are salt and, you know, that makes you different.
Yeah.
And you can't choose that.
That's right. And there's so much gift and invitation in this in a couple of different ways, I think, in ancient context, but in contemporary context as well. So one of them is at Richmond we have a pattern of the space for people to share and reflect at the end of the reflection time. Mm. And one time I invited people to share with one another, with those around them, what difference it had made to them coming to be a follower of Jesus. And people shared with one another and then some people shared back. And one person who was an asylum seeker shared that when they'd been on detention on an island offshore Australia, they were not from a Christian background at all, but they noticed the Christians.
Mm.
I said, what made you notice me? Said they had a peace that I'd never seen before.
Wow.
And it was the light in them. So I don't think he didn't give the impression anyway that they were preaching at him or trying to convert him, but he was drawn to the light in them and then wanted to explore Christian faith and later became a Christian. And I think that there's something profound about our orientation. So there's a real gift in our post-Christian context, I think, because we can get rid of the construct that the church equals tennis courts or the church equals the Saturday night dance or the church equals being a good citizen and a good business part, you know, all those constructs that were part of the church in the past that have nothing to do with, I mean, I'm not saying that they're wrong in themselves, but they have nothing to do with the way of Jesus.
It's much more radical.
Much more radical. Yeah. So we can get free of that. Jesus is not talking about numbers in this passage. Like you will be the light in every city on the place. And if you have too much salt in a meal, it can ruin it. Let's be honest.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it can.
So that we're invited, I think there's a liberation in this. We're invited to be little pockets of spicy community.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
You know?
That image.
Yeah. Mm. And to be that without compromising, without apology, without aggression though either. Just be that and let again, that language of divine isness just come through the pores of, you know, our skin or our interactions.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way the empires are in the world, you will be salt by definition.
Absolutely.
By living this alternative.
By living this alternative, yeah, not trying to fit into the culture and offering critique but in love, again, in that loving space, not in an arrogant space.
Yeah.
But I think most of all, embodying it and people recognising it and seeing it.
Yeah. That's right. Mm. And I mean, to draw us, and here I will agree with Bonhoeffer.
Oh, good on you, Robert. Yeah, that's right.
But to draw us back to our Christian identity, I mean, it seems to me that in some ways we can't focus on that too much. I mean, obviously we just shouldn't spend all our time navel-gazing.
Absolutely.
But, because that's what it comes down to. And this affirmation, as you said, Fran, that this is, you know, who you are. You are this now. Not you will be this when you get it all right one day. Or when you reach a certain level of piety and you can pray for 5 hours straight or things that, quite frankly, I will never attain to. But, this is who you are, and then live into it is the challenge of Matthew, I think.
And knowing that if we know that it's about mercy at its heart, then we can live into it with some hope rather than fear. Mm. So how Jesus says, mercy will be shown to the merciful in the passage that we looked at last week, that sense that we're not trying to do this to prove our place in the kingdom or to get God's approval, but because this is who God is and we're seeking to live into the same way, and we'll probably stuff it up. But as we show mercy, then we'll experience mercy as well as we keep, in our own faltering ways together, not just on our own, in communities.
Yeah, as communities.
To shine.
Well, shine. So the image of light's really a potent one in Epiphany.
Yeah.
And light emerges in the Isaiah reading as well today.
It does.
So I'd encourage people, though it is difficult in the Southern Hemisphere, midsummer, admittedly.
Where everything's light all the time.
Much easier in Scandinavia at this time of year to play with light in your worship space, but that would be something to think about with the imagery of this reading. But also, and this is perhaps a bit of going in a negative way, but just looking at the bushel basket here, no one puts it. So the bushel can be something deliberately but subconsciously sometimes to snuff out the light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we talk about what that might look like in Christian communities we know or have known?
I think probably different. Well, my theory is that every denomination sins in its own creative ways.
Yes.
And let us speak only of our own tradition. I think the Uniting Church has one of its sins is it's deeply impacted by culture, Australian culture. And Australian culture is, as we know, entirely skeptical of anyone who's too confident, unless it's in sport.
The tall poppy syndrome. Yeah. Yep.
And so there hasn't been a culture, not all the time, but there can tend to be, if anyone puts their head up too high, kind of
lop it off.
That's right. So how I think that's a really great invitation for how we can celebrate one another's light without feeling like we need to diminish it, and how we can celebrate others' light without being diminished ourselves, creating those communities. Mm. I mean, again, back to Paul, but that whole, that we do have different gifts and we should celebrate them and, to put down the competition. Mm. That's so core.
Because we can all be light. It's not like there can only be one light.
And we're all
or
called
one grain
to be
of
light.
Salt.
Yeah.
I wonder too, speaking generally in the Uniting Church, but it's mainstream Western Protestantism and Catholicism perhaps too, but it's the inferiority complex. This gets back to your observation or your pointing out here that, you don't want too much salt. Actually, that spoils and it spoils the meal.
Yeah.
And that we're being invited to be these tasty morsels in amongst.
So,
which is an invitation not to worry about bums on seats.
Absolutely.
Enormous churches. So I think there might be the bushel could be an inferiority complex that we just automatically have of ourselves as church communities. And so we apologise for what we're here for, or we don't talk about it confidently.
And I think part of the reason that also happens too is because in the Uniting Church particularly, where we are quite aware of the awful ways in which Christianity has been used as a tool for colonisation. Mm. We are aware of the empire-shaped ways that the church has sought to dominate, and in some parts of other denominations continues to seek to dominate the political landscape. And I think there's a really clear sense of not wanting to do that. But we need to reimagine how we can be strong but not arrogant, how we can hold it without apology but with openness. And there are definitely ways of doing that, but I think it's really important to practice it and model it. And
that comes back to identity, because if you know who you are, I mean, this is true of us as individuals, once you have a sense of yourself that you're comfortable with all our own frailties and none of us are going to be perfect at everything or even very much. But if you know who you are, then someone else being different is not a threat.
Absolutely.
You know, somebody else's otherness is a wonderful thing that you can encounter rather than it threatens you. For me, the bushel thing too, I see that internally in churches where the light might be a new idea or a bit of enthusiasm and the bushel just comes down and says, no, we tried that in 1976 and it didn't work.
Mm.
You know, that kind of like as opposed to something life-giving that oxygenates and says, let's give this a go and see what this flame does, we kind of snuff it out before it's even begun.
And what I'd add to that is then the challenge is to love those people.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean it quite seriously. Then because the response as humans can be, we'll stuff you. We're going to go and do it over here. But what I'm not saying that there might not have to be some movement, but the sense of, well, how can I love you in your no and seek to continue to hold my own ground but create some more space for the conversation.
Yep. You're listening to By the Well, and if you haven't rated us, we're going to ask you to please go onto iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and give us a rating. That helps other people find us as well. Now, we've got a few minutes left, and I wonder if we want to talk about the other part of this Matthew passage, which is that bit where Jesus declares, this is verses 17 and 18, you know, I haven't come to destroy the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them or accomplish them.
Mm-hmm.
And then this classic phrase about, you know, I'm telling you until heaven and earth disappear, not one stroke, not one dot is going to disappear from the law. I'm reading here from N.T. Wright's translation. What do we do with this? Because, of course, Christians, we know historically the relationship between Christians or we should be more accurate, Jewish believers and Gentile believers became fraught around issues of the law.
Yep.
We see this in Galatians over circumcision. Roman. It manifests in food laws and other things. And I think for most Christians today it's a bit of a non-issue because we think we just happily ignore most of Deuteronomy and Leviticus and don't think much of it.
And the concept of law is culturally very strange.
That's
apart
true.
From anything else, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So what do we do with Jesus saying here? How might we interpret this?
I think I'm really glad it's in Matthew because it's a reminder and a challenge to any kind of readings that go in an anti-Semitic direction. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is clearly in Matthew's gospel clearly Jewish and owning that. And again, the sense would seems to be in Matthew's gospel that Jesus is revealing the heart of what the law is about. So obviously it's speaking to a context in which these issues are starting to become more pronounced. Mm-hmm. And it would, like if you've been brought up a context where it's clearly don't eat that food and don't talk to those people because they're impure. And now you're in this Jesus community where some of these impure people are starting to come in and you're supposed to sit at the same table. Like these are really fundamental issues
and
around.
It'd be hard.
Really hard. And if your family's like, well, if you're going to hang out with them, you can't be in our family anymore, you know, because so much was linked with living in a pure way to be faithful to God. Like, so this became questions of you're being an atheist, really. Like, you're not being faithful.
Or if you become a Jesus follower, you're actually going to be forced, you will no longer be able to return and eat with your family
because
you've become impure to them. So there's real social cost to
really
personal crisis stuff.
Yeah, it's absolutely massive. Like the disruption is so profound, as well as those challenges to class as well that are really profound. That, you know, slaves are eating with owners. Like this is really
rad. And
that women
hard.
Are included. Like these are such radical disruptions of the construct. So within those debates, the Matthean Jesus is still saying the law is central.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
And then saying, and it is seen in mercy, not sacrifice. So it's holding and disrupting at the same time.
Yeah, I was going to say at the risk of preempting next week, this is where you've got to hold the whole of, you know, bigger pieces of scripture together.
Yeah.
Because we get this verse here about not one dot or dash will pass away. And then like a few verses later, he's going, you've heard it said this, but I tell you this.
Yeah.
And he's immediately not doing away with the law, but reinterpreting it.
It is. And he's making those claims in Matthew's gospel because he is the God one. God is with us. So I mean, that's the audacity at the heart of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's what people need to wrestle with because that's what's being presented. And so the question becomes, well, because we all, I think, whether people have been brought up in the church or not, have constructs of God, whether it's a Renaissance painting or Santa on a cloud or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone were to take Christianity seriously, they have to take seriously the notion that in Jesus, we do see what God is like. And oh my goodness, God is about mercy.
Yes.
And nonviolence.
The other thing I wonder about here is something else. One of the commentaries I was reading talked about this, that Matthew links that the law won't be abolished until heaven and earth are. Mm. But it's only in Matthew's, I'm curious about Matthew's timing. This is really a question rather than a full thesis. Because it's only in Matthew's gospel that we get these earthquakes around Jesus' death and again around his resurrection.
Yeah.
So Jesus' death and resurrection are already disrupting that cosmic
absolutely.
Order.
People rising from the graves.
Yeah, that's right. So hell is harrowed, to use the later creedal language. Yeah. So I wonder with Matthew whether this makes sense in its literary context in the gospel, but whether he already thinks heaven and earth have been somewhat done away with in the death and resurrection of Jesus, and at what point it's just a question what he's doing with time and those kind of things.
You know, I heard this is attributed to Brendan Byrne, but I think it's an excellent, someone in his class long, long ago chose to use the analogy of, you know, when you're down in the city loop and you can feel the wind of the train before it arrives, but you know that you can feel the wind that comes through the tunnel and then the train, that's almost how it's breaking in. Like, so the kingdom's breaking in and you can feel the wind of it, but the train hasn't quite arrived.
The wind comes first, the spirit.
So it's moving and you can feel it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. It's a nice imagery. We're almost out of time, but any last thoughts for preaching this, Sally?
Well, I think the imagery of salt is really beautiful to use in worship as well. So having a bowl of salt that people can take some, and it can be a symbol of tears. It can be a symbol of healing. Mm-hmm. It can be just to take that our bodies have lots of salt in them, like that notion of what does it mean to be salt? It can be a beautiful liturgical thing that might maybe fit better in summer in Australia. But
salt water, sea water.
Yeah.
That's right.
There is also an opportunity to talk about evangelism, particularly with this salt and light section too. I had a look at Eugene Peterson's Message translation.
What does he say? Yeah.
Well, verse 15, 16, keep an open house, be generous with your lives.
Oh.
By opening up to others, you'll prompt people to open up with God, this generous Father in heaven.
Beautiful.
So that's what he does with the shine the light.
Shine
people
the light.
People will see your light. Hmm. So he's kind of grounding it a bit in a more practical image of hospitality. Well, thank you so much, Sally Douglas, for being with us this week and last week, and for bringing the wisdom and insights from both your scholarly and pastoral ministry background.
It's been a great conversation, Sally.
Thank you. Great podcast.
And thank you to our listeners for listening. This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, the Uniting Church in Australia, and the technical assistance of Adrian Jackson.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.